League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jemp, Luke Cutforth, and special guest Alex from Are They Gay?
Woo-hoo! Hey!
This week, we are talking about a bisexual conspiracy, but first, a little YouTube comment.
Ooh.
This one says, I love Luke. He is the most honest. I am not an expert, but love to learn and not afraid of discussions person there is. Mm. Like, he's just on a mission to understand everything. Also, I love the way that he speaks. I just want to be Luke, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, me too. That's me and Corey, we're lying all the time. We're telling lies.
So, my question for you all today, if you are listening on Spotify or Apple or anywhere else where you only use your ears, head to YouTube and let us know this in the comments. Are you bisexual? Just want to know. Just curious. There you go. So, why don't we start off this episode? I wanted to do an episode on bisexuality for a very special Pride Month series because there's this little myth that it's been floating around.
Oh, yeah?
The little myth that bi men exist. Apparently, people say that bisexual men exist. I don't agree with it. So, no. I want to ask you all, what is bisexuality?
It's when you like more than one gender, right? Typically two, but more than one, I think, is the general consensus.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Anyone else got any definitions?
Typically men and women.
Well, I think the traditional thing that people would assume bisexuality means, and in part because of the etymology of bisexuality, usually people would imagine it means someone who likes men and women, or male people and female people. But the definition has been broadened somewhat to sort of mean that you... Yeah, like Jem said, are attracted to more than one of the genders.
Yeah. So this is the thing. I'm not erasing people. I am one of these mythical men myself. I should point out.
Off the grid.
That's a contradiction. You just said an impossible statement there, Corey. A paradox. The universe is going to implode.
So, yeah, bisexuality is usually defined as being attracted to two or more genders or the same and other genders. Probably the most common is the same and other.
Yeah.
And then previously it was both genders, and then that's kind of opened up as we've had a more, I guess, a less binary view of gender.
Yeah.
So that is, I guess, that's the easiest way to describe bisexuality. Are we all happy with that description? Yeah.
I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm rather happy.
Ecstatic.
Yeah. I'm thrilled.
So I kind of want to talk about the origin of bisexuality, because, I mean, does anyone off the bat know where the word sort of came from, where it had its origins?
Bi meaning usually means two, right?
Yeah.
Sexuality pertaining to who you find sexually attractive.
Yes.
I'm a linguist.
Yeah, the word bisexual. So, I mean, it comes not even from sexualities as we'd initially sort of think of them. In 1859, there was an anatomist, a person that studies anatomy. I hate that word. Mm. Any word that's like
anemone.
Yeah, anemone. It's all hard. So, an anatomist in 1859 named Robert Bentley Todd used the term bisexuality to refer to the possession of male and female physical characteristics in the same body, which nowadays we'd consider intersex. Yeah.
Oh.
Wow. Yeah. So that's where bisexual initially...
It's almost like language changes with time.
Yeah, right? It's mad. It's crazy. Like,
one
what's
could
that
say.
All about? So yeah, no, he used it essentially to refer to intersex people. And that meaning was then used by people in the 19th century. I mean, for the rest of the sort of 19th century. And it kind of evolved from there. So in the start of the 20th century, the meaning moved to be more about sort of masculine and feminine gendered characteristics, which is more androgyny nowadays. Mm-hmm. So bisexual went from meaning intersex to meaning androgyny, and nowadays we use the meaning that kind of started coming about in the 1910s, which is romantic or sexual attraction to sort of male and female characteristics, or masculine and feminine characteristics. Then obviously that is expanded further in the past few years as we've already kind of discussed. So that's where bisexuality kind of came from. But then again, in the 1970s, that's when we really got the proper modern meaning of it, which is attraction to more than one gender. So you can see how it kind of develops throughout time. Do you know what I mean? It's not been a sort of distinct, strict one definition from the start, which is really weird, because bisexual seems like the most straightforward, sort of, you know, the most straightforward description.
From the name, bisexual.
Yeah, it's very odd. So that's where that comes from. And it was interesting to me that it came from a sort of scientific place rather than anywhere else. Bisexuality. It came from that, literally referring to, I mean, intersex, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Didn't homosexuality also like come from a similar trying to categorize like people into scientific categories? And I think it has like a similar history to bisexual, and that it was viewed as kind of like a sexual inversion or like some kind of weird essential characteristic of people. And so it evolved over time in the same way. So it's interesting how these categories kind of come from that weird scientific place.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I think was the best for me in finding out where bisexuality came from in that respect. The word that we use now is that similar to homosexuality, it obviously came from sort of a science place. But in this case, it didn't seem to come from trying to say bisexual people were weird and had a mental illness, which is kind of, homosexuality, being trans, well, sort of gender dysphoria is still in the DSM-5. Mm. Obviously, they've shifted that from gender identity disorder, from, you know, the switch from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, we talk about this on the podcast so often, the fact that so many things that are just seen as normal identities nowadays, you know, if you go back 50, 70, you know, 100 years, those things were mental disorders.
Yes.
And it's when we talk about, you know, when people are saying the stuff that they're doing to trans people today, they were doing to gay people, you know,
20, 30, 50, 70 years,
that many years ago. It is the same. It's the blueprint. It's the same blueprint.
Yeah.
Because I think if you start at the start and just look at sort of how we deal with these identities in terms of mental health or treating them as mental illnesses, it becomes sort of readily apparent, because it is literally just the blueprint for how do we oppress the gays. They got gay marriage now. We can't oppress them as much as we used to, because people get mad about it. Who's next? Trans people, you know. It's just it's the same thing, just with different paint.
Yeah,
so that's how sort of bi terminology evolved. And I kind of want to talk really briefly about the Kinsey scale. So has anyone heard of the Kinsey scale?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we've talked about it before, haven't we?
We have talked about it very briefly before. Yes.
So it's a scale between 0 and 6. Mm-hmm. So it's 7 points. Mm-hmm. It includes 0. And 0 is it's a scale, basically, of how homosexual to heterosexual you are. So like a 0 is very hetero. And a 6 is very homo. Is that correct?
It's very true. Okay. Yes. So, yeah, the Kinsey scale is a measure of sexual attraction and behavior, which was developed by Alfred Kinsey and published in 1948. So it's quite old. So yeah, you're right. 7-point scale from 0 to 6. 0 exclusively heterosexual, 6 being exclusively homosexual. So that's kind of how it works there. And you need to understand this isn't an identity determinant. Mm-hmm. It is purely behavior and attraction. So if you exclusively have sort of heterosexual attraction and heterosexual behavior, then you'll be a 0. Yeah. If you exclusively have homosexual attraction and behavior, you'll have a 6. Yeah. I mean, but then this is what we talked about. Gosh, I can't remember exactly what episode. It might have been the gender episode way back. This doesn't necessarily map very cleanly onto sexuality, because the translation between this 7-point scale to the complexity of someone's identity is just there's things you're gonna miss in the middle there.
There's also different types of attraction.
It's interesting because it gives you a framework of thought as though bisexuality is like on the way to being gay. Mm-hmm. As opposed to I don't know like what makes us form our sexualities, but it's not necessarily a given that being bisexual is like being halfway to gay. Like, you could be bisexual for a totally different set of reasons as for the reasons why somebody could be homosexual or somebody could be heterosexual. It's just kind of a strange. It's helpful. I'm sure it was helpful at some time, and it's helpful in some applications. But it does suggest that sexuality is a spectrum from homosexual to heterosexual, with bisexuals in the middle of that spectrum, which might not. It might be true, but it also might not be true. And also, different people might be different things.
It's just a funny way of categorizing people. Like, a two is incidentally homosexual. It's like, how are you incidentally like, oh, whoops, I accidentally did the gay thing. It's like,
just happened to be homosexual.
Slipped and fell and sucked on a little.
Oh, no.
Oh, whoops.
A oopsie daisy.
Oh, no. Why does this keep happening to me?
It was an isolated incident.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is something I realized recently. And I was actually sitting in this very room. And I think I was working on a video where I was reacting to celebrity crushes, right? So I had to go through a list of all the celebrities that I would count as celebrities I had a crush on, right? And I realized there was this pattern in the women. I like masculinity in women. No. Like, we've had this whole thing where, you know, there's always been this joke of, if I am interested in a woman, she is not straight.
Yes.
Almost with entirely without fail, that woman is not straight. Thus far, I think a bunch of the celebrities that I've had crushes on that were women have come out. Like, it gets to be a problem. It's like almost a gaydar, like accidentally. And I realized,
so if Corey crushes on you, then you might find something out about yourself down the line.
Surprise coming in your future.
I can just tell. I know.
It's like a litmus test, Corey.
So no, but the realization came that I was kind of looking at the links between all of those women, and I realized, oh, it's just the masculinity, and it makes sense because if you're a queer woman, you're probably more comfortable in expressing masculinity than someone who may not be queer.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting how attraction works, because yes, I'm attracted to this trait, and I'm also attracted to this trait in women, and that is the through line of my attraction to women. But it's still an attraction to women. It's not necessarily women that sort of, you know, look masculine or have masculine features. It's a masculine sort of energy thing. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, they can still look feminine. They can still dress entirely feminine. Like, that is not the issue. It is. It's like that sort of energy. It's so odd how we simplify sexuality and orientation down to just generally a selection of maybe five words when everyone is so different. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to be the same as the next bisexual person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of who or what I'm attracted to.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many different like types of ways of being bisexual, because I know people who are more attracted to like a masculine or feminine or androgyny, but then I'm not that way. Like, for me, it's kind of like a blind, like, oh, I just like what I perceive to be beautiful, and there's not really like a pattern. Mm. But for some people, there is a pattern. And so just to put it all under the category of bisexual, sometimes it's not as useful to just put it all under this one giant umbrella. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it doesn't capture all that complexity.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I mean, this is what I'm so often talking about when it comes to categories. And I feel like I feel like that meme of Charlie Day from It's Sunny, It's Always Sunny, you know, like with like looking at the sort of conspiracy board behind it.
Like strings going up. Like,
categories. But this is what I'm talking about with categories. Categories are there to make things easier to understand, because our stupid, dumb monkey brains can only think of so much at once.
Yes.
You know? So instead of thinking about every individual human on the planet, it's just not possible. We gotta put them into little groups. And those groups can be incredibly useful if, for example, like, you know, a label wherein I'm like, I want to find more people that are similar to me. And people with the same label can have similar experiences, so that can be very useful. But when you start to use said label to say that, these experiences are all the same, you then start to lose the nuance. And that is something inherent in a category or, you know, a group like that. there's a lack of nuance. Yeah. And sometimes that's useful. Like, you know, losing nuance for, you know, sort of workability is very useful sometimes and absolutely necessary. But other times you want that nuance back. And this is what I so often notice, is that people seem to think that homosexuality and bisexuality and heterosexuality all exist objectively, and they don't. They don't. They're just group names that we've used to describe generally how people interact with one another. That's it.
And the thing you've just talked about there is something I hope that the sort of education system moves towards. Because we have, like, we talked on the podcast before about how we essentially have, like, a Victorian education system. And, you know, that's one argument that you can make about the education system, right? I'm not an educator. I don't know everything about it. But we live in a world, in an education system where a lot of your ability to pass exams is your ability to memorize things.
Yes.
Well, you don't need to memorize things anymore. You can ask Siri things. Like, you can ask Google things, right? You don't need, obviously memory is important, and being able to recall stuff that's relevant to your line of work. Yeah, great. But there are more important things about, like, the way you learn things, like metacognition and understanding that categories aren't real, and understanding how language affects your perception of the world. And those are things that we need to educate on too. And we spend such a tiny amount of time, if ever. I didn't realize that. About modeling and about how categories work and about how you simplify things until much later after my education. And I found that really annoying and frustrating when I learned it. And I went, oh, I was taught a load of useful but not true things, but I wasn't ever taught that they were useful but untrue things. I had to figure that out for myself. And I was flipping furious when I found it out. I was so angry.
Yeah, I understand that rage, because I have spoken about this a number of times on the podcast. I experienced that in school when in biology, every single year, they would tell us what they had lied about. And it drove me up the wall. I think I managed to maybe get to maybe fourth year or fifth year of high school before I turned to the teacher on the sort of first day. And I was like, what are you lying about this year?
Yeah.
Tell me.
Go on, tell me what I've got.
Tell
wrong.
Me what you're lying about. And he was like, look, it's more complex. And I'm like, I don't care. I want to know what the lies are, so I'm prepared for next year. Yeah. All right. I'm not dealing with this again. You can't be doing it. Because they give you simpler models as a child because it's easier for you to understand. And it's useful because it helps you understand that concept.
Yeah.
And it is perfectly viable for, you know, all of the things that you might want to do.
Mm-hmm.
In the same sense that in my day-to-day life, I don't need to know about quantum mechanics. I genuinely will never, ever need to know about that in my day-to-day life. Newtonian physics, though, kind of bloody useful a lot of the time, right? You know, understanding that, very useful. Understanding quantum mechanics, don't care. I don't need to. Doesn't exist.
Yeah. But
cat's dead, cat's alive.
You know.
Whatever.
You know that you don't know about quantum mechanics. So if someone, if there was some quantum phenomena come up, because you have a model of your own lack of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
You have a model that the models you have are wrong. And so if there was some quantum phenomenon going on, and a quantum physicist came along and was like, I know what I'm on about, you don't, you would be able to get that. Whereas we've talked before on the podcast about the it's simple high school biology argument when it comes to like vaccination, when it comes to immunity, when it comes to illnesses, when it comes to, and we're not, and it's so frustrating because people weren't taught the stuff they were being taught was a simplification. And I just, oh man, it fills me with no end of rage. I told this guy, this banker, about this once. I was chatting to a banker. I can't, weird thing to have a chat about with a banker, but he said that basically you'd have to upend the entire educational system if you wanted to do that. And that just made me go, cool, let's do it. That's not a reason to not do it. That's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately, I mean, I feel like we, the four of us, are part of the reason that the education system is not changing. Because, hear me out.
Oh, because we are providing
the sort of supplementary information.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, through the, like, because you can get that content online that doesn't necessarily teach it to you in the way that you would learn it in school, but you still get to grasp those concepts, you end up having people learn that outside of school. And so, I mean, it, realistically, the society that we live in does not want us thinking like that. That's not beneficial.
That's what I thought.
Absolutely not.
I don't want to be that guy who brings up the C word, but a lot of this is capitalism kind of just programming us.
Corey talking? No, he's not bringing capitalism. Capitalism Corey, we call him.
No, but like, it's no coincidence that the term homosexuality, bisexuality, these categories arose in the late 19th century, just when industrialization and capitalist development was just going on, because our society needs these categories. A capitalist society needs categories to run efficiently and to kind of categorize the world quickly and use these boxes to kind of rationalize its processes. And because if you have categories, you can work productively by just kind of simplifying, you know, the world, and then pumping out stuff based on simple categories. And so it's just that capitalist ideology of, well, if we simplify things, then it'll make things more productive overall, and we'd need the outcomes that we need to have be based on this kind of ideology of productivity, categorization, efficiency, and so on.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I totally agree. I think that another aspect of that is the hierarchy that's inherent in capitalism. Yeah. The hierarchy that's inherent and also entirely necessary for the functioning, or lack thereof, of capitalism, is that requires categories. You can't have a hierarchy if everyone is an individual that is more or less equal with, like, you know, all these different, because you need to choose, okay, who is on the top of this hierarchy and who is not, you know? Mm-hmm. And categories make that a whole lot easier. Yeah. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
It's the ad bell.
Well, the ad gods have asked us to promote our Patreon on this episode.
Hell yes!
Thanks to our patrons over at patreon.com/SciGuys, you get SciGuys every single week. But if you become a patron, you can get a whole host of other things. What can they get if they join our Patreon?
An extra episode a month.
You can get access to our super secret Patreon podcast, After Dark. Just because SciGuys has ended doesn't mean the conversation has.
That's right, and you can also vote on episode topics, submit episode topics for the vote, and some patrons can just get rid of democracy altogether and tell us exactly what episode they want us to make. You get bonus clips, behind the scenes stuff, lots of cool stuff over on our Patreon. You should definitely go and check it out right now. Patreon.com/SciGuys.
Don't miss it.
I agree.
Let's start the show again. So that is kind of, I guess, a little bit of a tangent away from what we're talking about today, but I want to kind of bring it back from, you know, through the sort of Kinsey scale, through bisexuality. I want to bring it back around to arousal patterns. So we've kind of spoken about the limitations of the Kinsey scale, right? That it doesn't show the full range of human sexual, I guess, sort of attraction and experience, really.
Yeah.
And You all know about, I say you all, I mean Luke, Champ, I know that you both know about arousal patterns in men and women. Alex, I'm curious, have you heard anything about arousal patterns in men and women?
No, I don't hang on those corners of the internet. No,
So in the episode with Jamie, we spoke about arousal patterns because that was part of Jamie's research, looking at arousal patterns in transgender men.
Yeah.
Now, usually what we would look at is arousal patterns in cis men and cis women. And what we found in cis women was responsible for headlines saying that all women are bisexual. And do you remember where that comes from, anyone?
The idea was that when they were trying to measure arousal between, was it like cis women and cis men?
Yeah.
Cis women tended to get aroused more by both men and women, whereas men tended to be one or the other, right?
Yeah, so that is a solid summation. When we look at cisgender, so this next little bit is only for cisgender individuals. If you want to know about trans people, Jamie has done, Jamie Rains, Dr. Jamie Rains, Jamie Dodger has done a wonderful study on this, which we covered in an episode a few months back. You could go and check that one out. So when you look at cis men and cis women, if you break it down by sort of sexuality, cis men, Even the ones that sort of class themselves as bisexual, who self-report as being bisexual, they only show arousal, physical arousal, to either men or women. So a homosexual pattern or a heterosexual pattern. Whereas cis women, straight cis women, are show arousal to both men and women.
Yeah.
And interestingly, lesbian cisgender women only show arousal to women. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. About
that. Hang on a second. Did you say that? Yeah. Did you say that bisexual men only show arousal to either men or women?
Well, that's if bisexual men exist, Luke, because clearly, since bisexual men only show attraction to...
But how do bisexual men then have sex?
So, so Luke, bear in mind that showing arousal to... When we're talking about this showing arousal to, I'm glad you brought that up. So, when we talk about showing arousal, this is based on laboratory studies. So, these are the... This is using the... This is essentially the way they do this, is they put the little band around the penis.
Yes.
And they show you porn in a laboratory.
Yes.
And they measure the change in the size of the penis. It's not like it's not, you know, fully erect means you're aroused, and anything else means not. They're very minor.
Is that not binary as well? I thought you're either erect or you're not. There's no in between. It happens in a single moment. Bang!
Yeah, all of that happens in a single moment for Luke. Anyway,
no, it was to do with like blood flow, wasn't it? So like the genital area.
Yeah. Yeah, to do with blood flow, and they measure that using this sort of little band around there.
Yeah,
and if you've got increased blood flow, that shows arousal, and you know that's to put it very simply. So in these initial studies, and I want to be absolutely clear, in these initial studies, that is what they found. Now this is going back to sort of 2005. Now I'm going to get a lot of this from an article in the New York Times from 2005, and the reason I'm taking it from there is because that kind of shows you how wide this story was. I mean, the New York Times published something on it, a bunch of different places were publishing something on it, and this is from a paper, pretty much not all of this, but a lot of this comes from a paper in 2005 that's one of the more modern ones that sort of confirmed, using that word very loosely, confirmed that bisexual men do not in fact exist.
It's canon.
So since this is a quote from the New York Times article. Since at least the middle of the 19th century, behavioral scientists have noticed bisexual attraction in men and women and debated its place in the development of sexual identity. Some experts, like Freud, concluded that humans are naturally bisexual in his landmark sex surveys of the 1940s. Dr. Alfred Kinsey found many married, publicly heterosexual men who reported having had sex with other men. Males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual and homosexual, Dr. Kinsey wrote. The world is not divided into sheep and goats. But in a study in 1979, it was on 30 men, the ones that were bisexual, that identified themselves as being bisexual, they looked the same as the homosexual men in terms of arousal. Mm-hmm. So they had a strictly homosexual arousal pattern. And what they then did was they did studies on gay and bisexual men in the 90s, and they again noticed that there were similarities between gay men and homosexual men. So in this survey in 1994 by The Advocate, and I'll just quote this, the gay-oriented news magazine found that before identifying themselves as gay, 40% of gay men had described themselves as bisexual. And I've got another quote here from Dr. Bailey, someone who studies this sort of stuff. I'm not denying that bisexual behavior exists, but I am saying that in men, there's no hint that true bisexual arousal exists, and that for men, arousal is orientation. Now, all of this is to say that from the sort of 70s to the 90s, there were these studies coming out and these surveys coming out that tried to say, that were kind of saying that homosexual men and bisexual men are the same group, right? Bisexual men are just homosexual men that haven't come out yet. And bisexual men don't have attraction to women. They only have attraction to men. And we can tell that based on the arousal patterns that we've measured in the lab. So this is where that myth of bisexual men not existing comes from. And also where the myth that all women are naturally bisexual comes from. So it's interesting that this is... is it not interesting?
This is a very... Yeah, it's very strange.
No, go on.
Well, it's just a very strange thing to go... look at one very small metric, which is blood flow, and then extrapolate that out to suggest that bisexual men, despite having reported that they very much exist, just don't. Like, but your blood vessels didn't dilate, so you're lying, or you're ashamed. One
can't
of those.
Control that. Sorry.
What I find interesting about that, and this is something that really grinds my gears, and again, it's something that we see still nowadays, is that when scientists studying this kind of thing come up against results that don't seem to make sense or marry with the reports of the people that they're studying, instead of thinking, maybe the methods I'm using to, you know, gain my results are flawed in some way. They think, these men are lying about being bisexual.
Yeah.
Silly lying, not bisexual men. They're actually just gay.
Can I check? So that actually came from... I know you just read the quote, so I apologize for this question. But that wasn't the headline, as in that wasn't created by the media who were reporting on the experiment. That was in the source text.
So if we're talking about the one from 2005, the one that this New York Times article was actually written about, I can just read some parts of it for you. Although bisexual behavior is not uncommon in men, there has long been skepticism that it's motivated by a strong sexual arousal and attraction to both sexes. For example, the case studies of Kraft and Ebbing in 1886 suggest that most men with bisexual activity have sex with women because of social pressure, but have sexual attraction exclusively or almost exclusively to men. And if we go down through the sort of results and get to the sort of discussion area, in any case, our results suggest that male bisexuality is not simply the sum of or the intermediate between heterosexual and homosexual orientation. Indeed, with the respect to sexual arousal and attraction, it remains to be shown that male bisexuality exists. So they're not saying that it doesn't exist. They're just saying that with respect to arousal and attraction, it doesn't seem to exist.
Yeah, but then again, how are you measuring attraction just by like blood going somewhere when, like we were discussing earlier, attraction can be so complicated and complex, and then there's like romantic attraction versus sexual attraction. So it's like these methods are just who knows?
Using too many words.
That's when the blood goes to the sex stick. That's what attracts.
That's what I learned in high school.
So I understand, obviously, that these scientists know a ton about this area of study. I think that maybe when they approach this, because there is some history of, I guess, a lack of evidence for male bisexuality actually existing, that's the kind of basis that they're building it off of. But it doesn't seem to be the case that they're questioning why that sort of that lack of evidence exists, right? And I feel like pretty obviously there is some bias in there somewhere that's resulting in the apparent fact that bisexual men don't exist, because you have all of these men who are saying, hey, I am bisexual, and if they're not showing attraction, or if they're not showing equal arousal or the arousal that's expected, maybe there's something that is making these results the way they are that isn't due to bisexual men not existing. But that doesn't really seem to be spoken about all that much. It's just built on layers upon layers of, we couldn't find evidence of bisexual men existing, and we still couldn't find any more evidence of all of this. But they were directly measuring genital arousal patterns and then using that to invalidate what these men were saying.
Yeah.
And I don't understand the argument of most bisexual men or bisexual men only exist due to social pressure. You know, they only sleep with women due to social pressure, because nowadays you would then expect to see bisexuality decreasing.
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you? I mean, and also...
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily need to see them... They wouldn't necessarily be having sex with women. They would just be saying that they're bisexual to escape. And it's... And again, I think it's built on this false premise that saying you're bisexual means you get way less discrimination than saying you're gay, which isn't true.
It's not true.
Yeah.
You get it just from both sides.
Yeah.
You know? Like, the gays don't want you and the straights don't like you. Like, it's not a better position to be in.
No.
I also feel like if there had been any... I mean, I don't know who the authors of this were, but surely if some women were involved... Because the natural extension, as was then included in the news as well, is that... there are no heterosexual women, and all the women in the entire world are just not, most of them are not sleeping with each other purely for societal reasons. And I feel like some women somewhere would have been able to go, no.
I've looked into this, and some of the reasonings that they come up with for this apparent arousal pattern in women are due to essentially women being aroused by any sexual activity as a evolutionary advantage. And I don't want to go more deeply into it. It's just a lot of the reasons that they get into for this are just, I mean, I understand where they're coming from with this, but I feel like some of the ways or some of the attitudes around this research are odd. it is odd to me to try and find a gotcha in research. Like, you were wrong about how you identify yourself,
yeah.
You silly. And this is what I was talking about earlier. I kind of was alluding to this, that it's really, really similar to trans stuff now.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that these papers are done in sort of bad faith. I don't think they are done in that sense, having read them, you know, in not in the same way that when you read certain papers about trans people, that from, like, I mean, I know this from the outset, I can often tell if it's written by a TERF or not based on the language used. That's based entirely on the language used. I won't judge the paper. I'll read the paper and I'll see, I'll judge it on its own merit.
Yeah.
But I can read a paper see how it's written. And if I go to the author's Twitter, I'm pretty much 100% spot on when it comes to whether or not they're a TERF, you know, yeah. Like it's very easy to tell. And that's kind of similar to some of the research that's being done today, that's being done almost to try to invalidate trans people, to say, hey, you don't exist. Hey, non-binary people don't exist, but they're there and they do. So instead of trying to find a way to say that they're actually wrong and or lying or deluded or anything like that, why don't you instead start from the premise that these people exist? Why?
And out of interest as well, I remember the study we talked about in the past, which was Jamie's study. This study, specifically, when they're getting cisgendered people, are they doing it with what is the thing that they're using to arouse people? Is it because in the study we talked about in the past, it was they were watching pornography or like solo pornography, I think. And is that correct?
This one, they're using pornography. I think it would have to be solo pornography. Yeah,
and that's also, and I know that they may mention this in the limitations of it, but that's just using one sense. It's just using the visual sense, and there can be many other reasons why somebody becomes aroused and somebody's attracted to somebody that aren't just the visual sense. It can be contextual. There may be. I don't know if humans use like scent with regards to like pheromones. I don't know if that. I don't think that exists in humans. I'm not certain. And it also like contextual, like the conversation you're having. Like Corey, you were saying about how when you what you found about yourself is that when you're attracted to women, it's usually more masculine women. Well, you might not get that from the visual sense. You might get it from the context. You might get it from getting to know them. You might get it from things they do, behavior, the way they hold their body, all those kind of things. And this really just cuts all that out and just goes, bi men, when presented with pornography, will have blood flow go to their penis for one sex. That is the limit of what you've discovered. And to extrapolate that out to like all these, this well-documented thing for thousands of years doesn't exist. Just, yeah. Well, super weird. Yeah.
What if the gay porn was just really good and the straight porn was just really bad?
I just found out. Like that is a solid point because I just found out what the porn is. So they showed them the neutral was 11 minutes of a relaxing film, which was just landscapes, and then followed by several 2 minute sexual films and another neutral film. Oh. Two of the sexual films depicted two men having sex with each other, and two of the films depicted two women having sex with each other. Oh. I'm sorry, I will just say this: watching women have sex in porn is incredibly uncomfortable because I know about the porn industry. If you're watching pornography with women in it, I don't understand how you could watch it and not feel uncomfortable thinking about the exploitation.
It makes more sense to me, though, that the bisexual men would be looking at two men getting together and being like, oh, that one of them could be me.
Because they can see themselves.
Because they can see themselves.
Yeah.
And then looking at two women having sex and going, oh, I'm not involved in
this.
Where am I
going to slot in?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like immediately upon looking at that, you're like, oh, well, this is an issue. And I understand this is why the solo thing makes more sense to some degree, but you've just hit on it there. I mean, what kind of videos are they showing them exactly? How do you measure whether the videos are the same level of good? And maybe, I don't know, let's just look at this through the lens of maybe there are some people that aren't all that attracted to certain groups unless they have some kind of other sort of attachment to them, you know, in that sort of demi way.
Yeah,
there are so many different possibilities here for like to explain the results, and they've kind of gone on the one that, while it seems apparent that male bisexuality doesn't exist in terms of arousal, does it? Does it really? Because I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I'm pulling this up so much. Because we've actually done more studies on this, and it turns out that bisexual men do in fact exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm what?
Sorry. That's crazy.
Whoa.
I'm glad to have brought this to you all.
News to me.
Yeah, I know. It's
Can
mad,
I ask,
isn't it?
Was anybody aroused by the calming 11 minutes of nature videos?
Luke?
I love a good landscape.
It does not say. And
that,
so
I'm furious about that. That's the control. That's your control. And you've not told it. I want to know.
No, so what I'm saying is it does not say that anyone was aroused. But it also doesn't say that anyone nature. Wasn't aroused, because why would they?
Well, I'm thrilled. Can't rule it out.
Yeah, this study, it's not a bad study. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say this is a terrible study and blah, blah. I see some issues with it. You know, I see some issues with how they've gone about it. And obviously, I don't know as much about this area of study as these scientists. I don't know that much about this area of study. But from my perspective, that seems to be an obvious flaw. And so obvious of a flaw that I don't quite understand how they would get around that. Do you know what I mean? And because I think the point of being able to put yourself in the sort of shoes of the, or lack thereof, of the person in the video is probably a key determining factor there. So I've actually found studies saying that bisexual men do exist, and shocker, I know. They're there, and this is what bothers me really, is that there were, you know, in recent years, quite a few studies that show that bisexuality in men seems to exist. So there's a study from 2020 saying bisexuality in men exists but cannot be decoded from men's genital arousal. I'm just going to read out the titles for you because they're all linked in the description, but I'll check them all out. Exploring sexual orientation beyond genital arousal, using large-scale online dating contact behavior to study male and female bisexuality. The male bisexuality debate revisited. Some bisexual men have bisexual arousal patterns. That was from 2011. And then you've got another one here. Bisexual orientation cannot be reduced to arousal patterns. That one's from 2020. You've got sexual arousal patterns of bisexual men revisited. I think I've already mentioned that one. I have. I'm just going through them again. There's sexual arousal patterns of identical twins with discordant sexual orientations. There's so many other studies on sexual arousal patterns. And since in the past few years, in the past decade or so, you found that bisexual men actually do exist. So they've been looking into this again and again. And, you know, they've found that there were clearly methodological flaws in the previous studies, or flaws in the interpretation of the data. And it's just one of those things where, yeah, obviously, I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to the point where we're saying, oh yeah, bisexual men who have existed for, you know, quite some time, turns out they do exist. Good job. Well done, everyone.
Wow.
No round of applause.
Big scientific achievement.
Science! Yeah. Thank you, science.
Ig Nobel Prize.
Yeah, so I kind of want to talk a little bit about the difficulties of science contradicting or disregarding lived experiences, because I feel like that's the kind of through line of this episode today. You know, it takes a certain degree of arrogance to say that someone's experience is wrong, rather than trying to determine why someone's results don't match said experience. It's kind of like being a doctor and your patient coming in and telling you that they're experiencing this chronic pain. And because you can't determine where the pain is coming from, saying, actually, no, the pain doesn't exist. No, you can't. Maybe your tools aren't, you know, good enough to find it. Maybe you don't understand something that is key to understanding why the pain is like exists.
Yeah.
All of this. There are so many other options before, if I can't see it, then it doesn't exist, you know? And being someone that is being told you don't exist, that is, it can genuinely be damaging, you know, because there are going to be men that are unsure of their sexuality, that think themselves bisexual, but are, you know, are go through periods of crisis thinking, oh, maybe I am just lying to myself. Maybe this, maybe that. And by sort of willy-nilly publishing these papers, making these claims, knowing that it's going to be picked up by the media and sort of said that this group doesn't exist, blah, 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 I think it's a little bit irresponsible. And that's not to say, you know, that we should hide science that I disagree with. I'm not saying that at all. I do think that we should hide all scientific papers that I don't personally okay and say that I agree with. That is a strong belief of mine, absolutely. But that's not what I'm saying right now. No, I just think that...
God, I hope that sarcasm comes across on the audio version.
Corey gets executive rule.
Sometimes I say something that should be said with a sarcastic tone, but it's almost funnier as an extra level of humor to say it fully deadpan.
Well, obviously, you should have to sign off on everything.
Yes.
Obviously. Yeah, that's true.
I know better.
Yeah.
My world, okay?
We know that.
No, so I do think that not necessarily that people need to not publish these kinds of papers, but if you're going to make the sort of claim, I feel like it should be clear within the paper that there could be limitations that you're unaware of. That, you know, we've tried to avoid all of these limitations, but from this evidence, we can't see this arousal pattern in men. So future research should go into figuring out why men have this sort of arousal pattern and yet identify as bisexual. Mm. You know, and the idea of social pressure and all of that sort of stuff, it doesn't seem to add up to me, because it's one of those things where it's very clear that it's someone that doesn't necessarily understand these sort of topics that they're talking about presenting an idea like, oh yeah, bisexual men say they're bisexual because it's easier to get out of, it's less scary than being gay. Is it though?
Mm-hmm.
Is it though? Because yeah. you're not going to be welcomed.
You have
less people inside overall.
You're not welcomed into gay spaces when you're bisexual. Like, you know, if you're not, if you're, especially if you're going, if you're actively pursuing, you know, the opposite sex or gender, if we're going to use a very crude term. But yeah, to sort of, I guess, elaborate further on this sort of issue with science trying to contradict or disregard lived experiences. I mean, as someone that uses science as my primary lens for engaging with the world, not my only lens, it's my primary lens, because I recognize that there are limitations. I find it interesting that people often try to use science to discredit others' lived experience. That doesn't necessarily add up to me. I can't conceptualize thinking, I don't like trans people very much, so I am going to find a scientist that says that they are wrong and they are lying, and actually we should not be nice to them. You know, I guess it makes logical sense if those are your goals, like that it's a logical conclusion to follow to follow through on. It's
quite funny how much it overlaps with how people use religion to discredit like marginalized groups. And you know, it's the same, like, oh, my set of rules don't allow for you, so sorry, you don't exist, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're it's an interesting point you raise there, because I feel like science almost has an inbuilt sort of system to avoid that. Not necessarily 100% of the time, it's supposed to have inbuilt systems to avoid that. Whereas religion, I was talking about this, I think, in a video recently. Religion as a basis of moral framework is not bad. You know, it's not a bad basis for moral framework. My issue is that often with religion, it comes down to debating whether this word of God, what the word of God means, sort of, right? So does this passage in the Bible mean this, or does it mean that? That is how we're going to determine our morality, based on this book, this book. But because there are so many subjective interpretations of said book, that's where the debates come from.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas with non-religious moral frameworks, it's more about the sort of subjectivity of that individual sort of topic that you're talking about, the sort of topic at hand. So you're not bringing it back to, you're not discussing whether God thinks it's good or bad, or what God has said about this or that. You're discussing whether the thing itself is good or bad. You're having to justify whether it's morally good, morally bad, all that sort of stuff, right? And when it comes to using religion as a basis for it, it's very easy to just say God says gay is bad.
Sorry.
God said it.
God didn't say gay
bad. Them's the rules.
It's
a mistranslation.
God said gay bad, Luke. But God said it.
God didn't even say things in English. Said things in other languages.
But this is my... So, and it's not that either are inherently bad. Whereas with science, you're supposed to have many people sort of working on it, and it's supposed to be repeatable and testable and all that sort of stuff, so that, you know, one person on one corner of the planet can test something that someone on the other corner of the planet did, and ideally they'll be able to get similar enough results, right? And so you'd think that would then mean that there's supposed to be a sort of lower chance of that sort of thing happening, saying you are not valid because of this thing that
it's
I've
meant
got.
To check itself, you know?
Yeah, it's supposed to check its own work, whereas religion... And I'm speaking terribly generally here.
Yes.
Because I'm not trying to just, you know, like, say religion bad. But religion doesn't have that... It doesn't necessarily have the same sort of inbuilt, I guess, system for avoiding that kind of thing, which mm-hmm. I think is really interesting. It's interesting that you bring up that to make that comparison.
Science has the other problem, which is evidenced here, actually, which is that science tries, by design to a certain extent, to not believe things until they're proven. And so that comes with its own problems, because some things aren't testable and some things you haven't tested for yet.
That's so true.
And it's not taking things like lived experience as fact. It's going, well, we found this data and that doesn't support the experience. So now we'll just say, well, we've proved it to not exist.
Well, see, I would argue that something that is missed is that, you know, data is data is data. If there are people reporting themselves to be bisexual, then there are bisexual people. Okay, if that means that bisexual people don't show a bisexual arousal pattern, sure, then the definition of bisexual is slightly different to what we initially thought. But there are X number of people that are saying, I am this thing.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't necessarily... I mean, I know that that is a limitation of science. Like, I absolutely agree with you. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't need to be. If you adopt the sort of viewpoint that I've got, wherein, okay, there are this, you know, like we've got 1% of people saying that they're trans, right? We've got 1% of people saying that they're trans. Now, I can't find any evidence to help me understand as to why these people are saying that, but those people are saying it. That is bottom line. That's the bottom line
that's
fact.
That's what I mean, is that with, from the scientific perspective, there are 1% of people saying they are trans is not the same thing as there are 1% of people who are trans.
I know, but what I'm saying is if we're going from the starting point of these people are saying that they're trans, let's figure out sort of why or how or whatever, right? So there's no need to try and invalidate trans people or try to find out, you know, if we can't find the reason why. There's no reason to then say, well, they don't exist. Yeah. Because we know that they do exist. We can see them. We can measure that they exist. We just can't measure. We can't figure out why or how.
Yes. All I'm saying is that definition you've just used, when you say what you'll have to change your definition of trans to make that make sense from the data you presented. Trans meaning people who say they're trans.
Mm. So my point is that instead of this is kind of the issue. Instead of saying X doesn't exist, either you've got kind of two options. Either you could say, well, X clearly does exist, but we don't know why, and we are struggling to figure out why. And you know, we like every kind of avenue we've gone, that it doesn't make sense thus far. Or you can slightly alter the definition of what you're talking about. So if we were operating under the assumption that bisexual meant having an equal arousal to both men and women, then that's not, you know what I mean? That means that our sort of definition of bisexual is not necessarily concordant with how actual bisexuals present. So instead of saying that the people are lying, it's more a case of thinking, well, maybe our definition or the sort of premise that we've got this built on is wrong. And I don't know. I mean, evidently, from the wealth of studies that have come out since, there was some kind of mistake somewhere along the line with these studies that were saying that there was no bisexual arousal pattern in men. And they were, like, a lot of them were kind of small-scale studies. You know, like 30 bisexual men is not all that many. Mm. And certainly, I don't think, enough to claim that there's no bisexual arousal pattern, especially since for some of the men, there was no arousal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I just think that when we're approaching these kinds of topics, we need to be a lot more careful in the conclusions that we come to. And we were talking about this in the Gay Gene episode, a few years back with Roe and Ellis. And I just think that it's not bad to, say, look for a gay gene. It's not bad to study bisexual people. It's not bad to study trans people. But we need to be very careful, because if we're, you know, so let's say we find a gay gene, the immediate next thing is then trying to make sure that our kids don't have the gay gene sort of thing. Mm. You know what I mean? It's I'm not saying that we can't do this thing. We just need to be conscious of the repercussions of sort of the results of our study and who it's going to be used by and what for. Yeah. And I think that's just a level of responsibility that needs to be sort of taken into account.
I think that in my view, it's almost like you almost can't do it with certain categories or identities, because science sometimes, with in the case of sexuality, is trying to make something concrete or material out of something that for a large part of it is social. Yeah. So for example, like sexual attraction isn't like constructed, or it isn't something that is made up. Like sexual attraction that you have is real, but that identity of bisexual or homosexual is socially constructed. And so to try to make that concrete through scientific evidence, or to try to operationalize the identity through something like blood goes to stick, it's not super you're not going to get the results that you're looking for, because these identities and categories aren't like the product of, they're not written into the fabric of the universe. They're also a part of social processes and social mechanisms. So science almost can't study it in the way that it wants to, because it's not like a question of the material world. It's like a social question.
And you can easily overlook things as well sometimes with experiments. Like the one we read out earlier could have nothing to do with sexual attraction and how it manifests, but it could be to like how people relate to porn and how people engage with porn, and it could have absolutely nothing to do with like face-to-face interpersonal attraction.
There are a number of confounding factors.
And
watching porn and having sex are not the same thing.
Not
remotely. I mean, like the you know, as evidenced by the fact that like there are certain, like I know people that don't like watching porn at all.
Yeah.
Or don't like watching a certain kind of porn, or only exclusively watch X kind of porn, despite having a different attraction that would not indicate that that's kind of porn that they want to watch.
Yeah.
And something that was really interesting that was brought up last week by Ramon was that, you know, these identities haven't existed necessarily for all that long. Yes, there have been people that are, okay, how do I put this? There have been people who are men who have sex with men, but that doesn't mean that there have been gay men.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or bisexual men. These terms, these labels, they're socially constructed, and so they've had to come into sort of existence at a certain point, and they've also changed over time. And that's the thing. They are very malleable, as evidenced by the fact that bisexual now has a different, is going through like three or four different iterations of what it bloody means.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to talk about, you know, words change over time, like that's about, words change over time.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, that's how it works. Sex and gender have changed over time. Gender was not initially used to mean anything remotely similar to what it's being used for today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are so many ways that language can grow and evolve over time. And I think it's really kind of frustrating in this respect when science approaches something as complex as sexuality with very strict and distinct categories. So when you're looking at bisexual men, okay, bisexual cisgender men, and you're showing them a video of two women having sex and two men having sex, there are so many men that are going to ID themselves as bisexual that are only going to have attraction to maybe one of those videos.
Yeah.
And when it comes to like the full resolution of sexuality, you know, when you look at it not just by breaking it down into the categories, but try to look at the sort of full spectrum and see it for all of the nuance, it is stupid complex. You know, I mean, the Kinsey scale, for example, just completely breaks. Like, it just it breaks down entirely when you start introducing trans, intersex, non-binary people. Yeah. Like, how do you fit these groups into the sort of Kinsey scale?
You know? Need like a lot of Kinsey scales stacked on top of each other.
Yeah. And going just, in different dimensions and whatnot, right? Okay, so like, I really want to talk about this. I feel like we've not had a chance to talk about this on the podcast necessarily before, but sexual attraction doesn't make any sense, right? When you really think about it, right? The way that we deal with sexual attraction is that, you know, I'm a heterosexual man, therefore I'm only attracted to women. But I'm not attracted to all women, I'm only attracted to certain kinds of women, these kinds of women. And if you look at all of the partners or all the people that I've been attracted to, you might see a kind of pattern. But actually, we don't sort of label my sexuality based on the specific pattern of women that I'm attracted to.
Mm.
We just say that I'm straight because all the people have been women. Yeah. Right?
Because sex is for mating, Corey, and nothing else.
Yeah, sure. No, so when it comes to sexuality, it's really interesting to me because it can be really difficult. So you see someone on the street and you think, oh man, I'm attracted to them. And then you find out that they're not the gender that you thought they were.
Yeah.
And your attraction can immediately disappear.
Mm.
Right? And it's very clear that there's more to attraction than just the sort of physical appearance. There's also other aspects that come into it in with regards to sort of what someone's gender is. Like, someone could look exactly, like, you could have, say, two twins that look exactly the same, and they're of different genders.
Yeah.
And someone will have a different attraction to both of them, because it's not just these sort of strict, simple physical categories that we're talking about, you know? And you could have straight people, like, you know, straight cis people being attracted to trans women and cis women exactly the same. You could have some straight people that are, like, straight men that are, you know, attracted differently or attracted not at all. There's so many different variations of human bodies. And when we talk about the complexities of sex, I mean, we were talking, I think just personally off pod recently, about how the difference between sort of male genitalia and female genitalia is not all that different, and there are some sort of there are some presentations that are more towards the sort of center of that could be ambiguous. And when we try to break attraction down really kind of into gender and sex being one thing, and it just doesn't, as soon as you start looking at the full complexity, it just breaks down entirely. You know, the easiest, not the easiest, the most accurate way to determine everyone's sexuality, and I mean the most accurate way, is to give it a name, to give every individual's sexuality a name, because they're all different and just entirely different. We're just, I think that people don't realize that when it comes to sexuality, all that is just saying, okay, this is generally the kind of person that I'm attracted to. They generally tend to fit into this box. And for most people, that generally covers, like, pretty much all of the sort of eventualities. But we've known someone that's, you know, that's a straight man, ostensibly, but was in a relationship with a trans guy and was perfectly comfortable with using the term boyfriend and all of that sort of stuff. And he was still, what was still considered himself straight. And it's just, people seem to think that the language is the thing rather than the language being a very crude way of trying to describe the thing. The thing in this case being the experience.
Yeah.
I would like to submit a new definition for the term bisexual, which is somebody who is sexually attracted to people saying goodbye.
Bye.
Very good. I'm so very bisexual.
Oh, the blood flow.
No, but it is interesting to me, actually, because when we talk about bisexuality, you know, that's one of the really difficult ones, because straight and gay are usually pretty straightforward, right? If a girl says, I'm straight, I'm like, ah, the dudes, they get you. I see. I understand what you're talking about. If someone says I'm bi, I'm like, okay, but, like, which one? Like, which one of the bisexuals are you? If someone says pan, I'm like, okay, cool. I know. That's fine. You're all good. But when you're bisexual, which one are you? Like, which one of the, like, you know, 7 to 28 bisexual?
I don't understand.
Are you a disaster? Is that the kind of one? What's your deal?
Martin's, Converse.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, what is it? Like that was it. Like the cuffed jeans.
Yeah.
And I mean, but really, like, seriously, you know, you could be bisexual and attracted to non-binary people and men, or, you know, people of only this specific gender and women, or, like, you know, realistically, you could even say these two different non-binary identities are the only types of people that I'm attracted to. I'm not attracted to men or women. You could still be bisexual.
That is too.
It gives you very little information. The only information that the word bisexual gives you is, and it's really annoying, the only information that it gives you is, this person is not straight or gay and doesn't want to call themselves pan reason based on their definition. Because it doesn't even tell you that, like, someone could say I'm bi and they could be attracted to literally, like, gender could not really factor into their attraction.
Yeah.
You know, because they've just, like, but just, that could be the, like, you know, which would generally be the definition of pansexual, but there's some overlap there. But it could also, like, you know, bi could mean, you know, gender doesn't factor in, but it could also mean gender absolutely does factor in and it's only men or women. Or it does factor in and it's women and non-binary. But, like, it's just, it gives you so little information, and yet we construct an entire identity around the word. And it's okay in that sense, in that we've got a lot of we can have a lot of shared experiences, but people often, I don't think, recognize just how varied people within that group are, because fundamentally the only thing that is tying people in that group to each other, the only thing, is that all of them are not straight or gay, and that's it.
That's it.
It's like, it's when you describe it like that, it becomes very apparent that actually the language that we use is a very, very crude way of I mean, I feel like people, okay, if you look at, say, I don't know, the Mona Lisa, or a very, very, you know, very, very intricate CGI, I feel like people think, if we're going to put our language on a scale of sort of describing the world from cave paintings to modern CGI, we're on the cave paintings end when it comes to language, man. Yeah, like, language is not nearly good enough to describe the bloody universe around us.
Yeah. And I feel like some people have made efforts to create new terms, like pansexual and like asexual and demisexual. And there's a lot of like terms that you could call new, even if they might have been around a while, but it still doesn't like do it. It's not enough. There's still so many like axes of attraction that just aren't accounted for.
Because ultimately it's something that is not, it's not possible to simplify. It's not possible to, okay, so if you simplify it and use fewer words, then it's easier to understand but less accurate.
Yeah.
If you are more sort of nuanced in your view, then you've got more words and it's more unwieldy.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to categories, I'm going to be incredibly simple here. So simple. When it comes to these kind of categories and labels and whatnot, you are essentially, you've got a tug of war between sort of ease of use and, I guess, accuracy.
Yeah.
And if you want more accuracy, oh God, that's so hard. Like, accuracy in biology, I hate.
Mm-hmm.
I say accuracy, more specificity, right? It doesn't necessarily exist to the sort of absolute degree. You know, with quantum mechanics, we could talk about all the different quarks and whatnot, right? And be very specific about what we're talking about. It comes to biology, man. We're like, okay, like, species, I guess, but some overlap here. I don't know, man. You know, like, just fucking animals. They're alive. They're doing the thing. We can't control them. Like, biology is stupid complex. And when people try to simplify it down to male, female, and exception, it genuinely pisses me off.
Yeah.
I think that's more or less the episode for today. Dear me, we've gone on quite the journey. So, before we go, we've got maybe one little thing to do.
What's that?
It's a quickfire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Bisexual edition.
So, the rules of the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between the three of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. What did they win, champ?
One. Bisexual.
It's me. Hello. You win me. Luke, what is your buzzer?
Bye.
Champ, what is your buzzer?
Sexual.
Not champ.
What?
There's three people here.
Oh, sorry. Sex.
And Alex, okay. Your buzzer. And Alex, sure. Your buzzer. Awesome.
Let's finish it off, yeah.
Fantastic. So, the question for you today is, who developed the Kinsey scale?
Shul.
Sex.
Alex, go ahead.
Alfred Kinsey.
Ding, ding, ding. Oh. That is correct. And for a bonus point, can you tell me when it was published?
1948.
Ding, ding, ding. Whoa! Oh, we have someone that listens. Amazing. Congratulations. I think this is the best performance in a quickfire quiz yet.
Yeah, probably.
A low bar, but well done.
I forgot his first name.
Well, I think that is it for this week. But before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Danito. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday and leave us a nice wee review. You can follow the pod at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeHelpful everywhere.
I am the bi guy. I'm at Are They Gay everywhere.
Fantastic. Well, goodbye.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.